In a rare show of strength, the opposition parties and the government joined hands in Pakistan's parliament to pass a unanimous resolution over what it said unending war crimes against unarmed Palestinians by Israel. The parliament called on a 57-member bloc of Muslim countries, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation or the OIC, to now undertake decisive steps to bring an end to ongoing unilateral war against innocent Palestinians. However, not very far from the parliament, the anti-Israeli protesters are not willing to trust OIC given its track record of failures. The protests in Pakistan are expanding given the relentless bombing by Israel, killing Palestinians since last week when Israel imposed unilateral war on Gaza after it attacked the third holiest site of Islam in the occupied eastern Jerusalem.
If their anger is not being expressed by the leadership of the Islamic world, I think they will go on their own. And I believe that an Arab Spring is about to restart. And this Arab Spring is not going to just remain to the Arab boundaries, but it will even come to Pakistan and beyond.
We want action against Israel!
These are Pakistani journalists. They are at pain over a growing scale of violence against international media networks and journalists in occupied Palestine by apartheid state of Israel. They protested and observed Black Day against Israel for killing innocent Palestinians and bombarding commercial infrastructure, housing international media networks, and Palestinian residents. International Federation of Journalists and Political Analysts point out that the frequency of the incidents with which journalists have been attacked with potentially a lethal force in the occupied Palestine indicates about the existence of a formal official policy to silence the media networks and journalists who are struggling hard to document the war crimes of Zionist state. However, so far, Israel has enjoyed impunity from all the war crimes it has committed against the unarmed Palestinian, given the fact it enjoys unconditional support from the U.S. and other NATO allies in the Europe.
It only goes to show that the American moral power and European moral ascendancy also has limits. They are fast losing their moral authority to lecture the world on human rights.
More protests are planned on Friday when the clerics in hundreds of thousands of mosques and Islamic schools are expected to make anti-Israel speeches. Javed Rana, Islamabad. It is the beginning of a series of public protests in Pakistan over no let-up to the atrocities against Palestinians by Israel in the occupied land. Like elsewhere in the Muslim world, people are raging with anger in Pakistan since last week when Israel attacked Al-Aqsa Mosque in the occupied Al-Quds Sharif and later waged a unilateral war against unarmed Palestinians in Gaza. The Al-Aqsa is the third holiest Islamic site, the desecration of which by Israel has led to the beginning of a renewed wave of public anger against Israel in this part of the world.
Israel!
More protests have been planned to build a public pressure on government to stop ongoing attacks on unarmed Palestinians. Before protests like this one spread across the country, Pakistan has raised the issue in a virtual emergency meeting of Executive Committee of Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or the OIC, a 50-member bloc of Muslim countries.
There are no words strong enough to condemn the systematic and barbaric crimes against the Palestinians. The deteriorating conditions in the occupied Palestinian territories due to the illegal practices of Israel, the colonial policies and its continued aggression, siege and collective punishment are sickening.
However, people attach little hope with the OIC, given its track record of doing little beyond issuing anti-Israel statements. People are particularly angry against the Muslim rulers, including their own, for restricting their official reaction so far to mere customary statements of condemnation, which they say is no longer acceptable to them. They want particularly Pakistan, Turkey and Iran to undertake concrete measures to prevent of what they call Israeli aggression at a time when many Arab countries have been allegedly siding with the apartheid state.
Our Prophet, peace be upon him, said that Muslim nation is just like the one body. If one part of it gets injured, the other part would feel its pain. Israel is committing atrocities on our children, brothers and sisters. It is obvious that we feel its pain. Our hearts beat with our Palestinian brothers. Pakistan and other Muslim countries now must declare a jihad against Israel.
The latest round of Israel's unilateral attacks started after Palestinians resisted the forcible eviction from their homes in the eastern Jerusalem Al-Quds. Since then, Israel has killed scores of Palestinians, including women and children, and injured many others. The housing and commercial infrastructure, including offices of international media houses in Gaza, have also been bombarded to silence the reporting of events from the occupied land. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Hundreds of Austrian protesters gather outside the office of Chancellor Sebastian Kurz, expressing their anger at the government's decision to take Israel's side as it continues its deadly bombardment of the besieged Gaza Strip.
Protesters were not given legal permission for a large demonstration, but they did gather outside the Chancellery, expressing outrage at the fact that the Israeli flag has been hoisted on top of this building.
Organizers said that by raising its flag and expressing solidarity with Israel, the government has violated Austria's constitution.
Our main protest is we want this flag to be down because this flag is against our constitution. Our constitution stipulates neutrality, and our government takes side with a war party, with a party which violates systematically the rights of other people, of the Palestinians. They evict them, they ethnically cleanse them, they take their land.
Political commentators say Austria's one-sided political position runs contrary to the country's traditional policies founded on democracy.
This is unbelievable, and I'm sure that many of the Austrian people, because nobody was asked about this, this was a coup d'etat, this with the flag. And I'm sure that many of the Austrian people don't accept this. I'm here because we are siding the Palestinians, we are fighting their rights, but we are also protecting our rights as Austrian, as European Democrats.
We want the Palestinian people to know, and we want the Israeli government and the Austrian government to know that we will not be quiet, that we cannot be quiet down, and that the Palestinian people have a right on their land, and they have to stop this colonial expansion now.
Activists say they will continue their attempts to pile public pressure on the government and are calling on authorities to give them back their right to demonstrate. Homalezgi, Vienna.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The people of Palestine are once again going on a strike for their liberation and calling on the world to join them. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Julia Conley Ryder. This article is published under the heading global solidarity protest against Israeli regime apartheid as Palestinians stage general strike. Stay tuned for more. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians across the occupied West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and occupied Palestine took part in a historic general strike on Tuesday, May 18th, and were joined by the international community, who staged solidarity demonstrations to denounce the latest attacks by the Zionist regime military, which have killed at least 212 people, including 61 children, and wounded thousands more. Palestinians across the region gathered in public spaces where they marched, listened to speeches, and chanted against the Zionist regime apartheid. Stores, offices, universities, and other establishments were shuttered. In dozens of cities across the U.S. and around the world on Tuesday, May 18th, demonstrators gathered to express solidarity with the Palestinians amid the recent spate of violence and attempts by the Israeli regime authorities to forcibly displace families in East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. In the U.S., Jewish Voice for Peace worked with local groups and cities nationwide to organize marches, rallies, and vigils. In New York, protesters gathered at the Israeli regime mission at the United Nations before marching to Senator Chuck Schumer's home, the offices of AIPAC and Friends of the IDF, and Golda Meir Square, which the group symbolically renamed. Other rallies and vigils took place or were planned in Washington, Seattle, Chicago, and other U.S. cities. Internationally, there were protests in Jakarta, Istanbul, Beirut, and elsewhere. The Institute for West Asia Region reported that Palestinians who gathered in occupied East Al-Quds were met with violence by police. It's the first time in decades that we see Palestinians across the political divide take part in such a general strike, Al Jazeera Nida Ibrahim said, reporting from Ramallah. As the Global Grassroots Coalition Progressive International tweeted, the last general strike held by Palestinians lasted for 174 days in 1936. Today, the people of Palestine are once again going on strike for their liberation and calling on the world to join them. The time has come to end the Nakba, Progressive International tweeted, referring to the displacement of more than 700,000 Palestinians who fled or were expelled from their homes in 1948. On the ground in the West Asia North Africa region, Palestinians circulated a manifesto of dignity and hope, which called on participants in the general strike to write a new chapter of courage and pride in which we tell a story of justice and of truth that no level of Israeli regime oppression can erase. The truth is that Palestinians are one people, one society. Zionist gangs forced out most of our people. They stole our homes and destroyed our villages. They tried to turn us into different societies, each living apart, each in its own separate prison, the manifesto reads. It is now the time for this tragedy to end. According to recent reports, Gaza's medical infrastructure has suffered a major blow as two senior doctors died amid the ongoing Israeli regime bombing campaign that has killed at least 200 Palestinians and wounded more than 1,300 others in the coastal strip while straining a healthcare system already reeling from the Zionist regime's 14-year blockade. Dr. Ayman Abu Auf, head of internal medicine at Al-Shifa Hospital, died with an unspecified number of relatives when the Zionist regime missiles struck his family's home in the Al-Weda district of Gaza recently. At least 33 people were killed in the attack, according to Al Jazeera. Speaking about Al-Auf's death, former student and Al-Shifa colleague Dr. Osaid Al-Asr told Al Jazeera, "It is a shock for me and for the entire medical community. He is one of the most senior internal medicine doctors in Gaza. That means a huge loss to the medical community. In addition to being inundated with the wounded patients, hospitals and clinics, which were repeatedly attacked during past Israeli regime campaigns, have again been hit in Zionist regime strikes. The international medical charity, MSF, also known as Doctors Without Borders, said recently the bombing damages trauma and burn care clinic in the neighborhood, forcing its closure.
In September 1978, U.S. President Jimmy Carter, who was really concerned about peace and security in the world, invited the two sides of a major conflict to a meeting. His guests were Anwar al-Sadat, President of Egypt, and former fighter and the Prime Minister of Israel, Menachem Begin. After 30 years of fruitless Arab-Israeli wars, both sides preferred to talk secretly about the conflict for a few days. The secret talks needed a comfortable place, and it was situated in Washington Northwest Road on top of the forested hills. It was Camp David, the country retreat for the President of the United States. It is a place filled with trees, good weather, and also important secrets. Of course, this was not the first time that the United States held itself accountable for Israel. Jimmy Carter was not the only one who had this sense of responsibility in U.S. government. The first and perhaps most responsible U.S. president on the Palestinian issue was Harry S. Truman. The most important place to express this sense of responsibility was in the United Nations General Assembly to divide Palestine into two independent states, Arab and Jewish. It was possible to create a nation with the vote of the majority and give them land in the same place.
Those who are in favor will say yes, those who are against will say no.
Afghanistan, no. Argentina, Argentina, abstention. Egypt, no. Iraq, no. Lebanon, no. Soviet Union, yes.
United Kingdom, abstain. United States, yes. Paraguay, yes.
The resolution of the Duck Committee for Palestine was adopted by 33 votes, 13 against, 10 abstentions.
Israeli flag was hoisted outside the United Nations just after this session. When the UN General Assembly voted on the partition plan for Palestine, The Zionists did not keep the great powers waiting. The representative of the Jewish agency at the UN told the members of the Security Council what they were waiting for.
Not later than May 16th next, a provisional Jewish government will commence to function in cooperation with the representatives of the United Nations then in Palestine.
But at the first step, the White House acted against the Zionist expectations.
The U.S. State Department argued against it. Their first response was, no country, no state.
The situation was not good at all, so the Prime Minister of Israel, Moshe Sharet, was sent to the United States so that he might be able to change the strong-willed United States Secretary of State's opinion on the recognition of the State of Israel. But George Marshall did not agree at all. Marshall went to the White House to talk to Harry S. Truman, and he realized that the president did not agree with him and had different ideas about Israel. Clark Clifford, the White House counsel, was also present in that meeting.
General Marshall started off. The president listened attentively and then said, I would like now to hear from Clark. But as I spoke, I saw Marshall's face getting redder and redder.
George Marshall realized that Truman supported Israel for two reasons, Zionist money and votes in the upcoming elections. And Truman mentioned this point explicitly. However, Marshall tried to make Truman aware of the consequences of his decision.
We are in the midst of a very critical situation. We should, therefore, carefully avoid approaching international problems on an emotional basis.
Finally, Marshall said that if Truman recognized the Israeli interim government, he would not support his candidacy in the upcoming elections. But 2 days later, on May 14, 1948, the leaders of the Jewish National Council went to this building, the Tel Aviv Museum, to proclaim the establishment of an independent Jewish state. Shortly before this announcement, Eliyahu Epstein, head of the Jewish agency in Washington, wrote to the U.S. president that the Act of Independence would become effective at 1 minute after 6 p.m. on May 14, 1948, Washington time. With full knowledge of the deep bond of sympathy which has existed and has been strengthened over the past 30 years between the government of the United States and the Jewish people of Palestine, I have been authorized by the provisional government of the new state to tender this message and to express the hope that your government will recognize and will welcome Israel into the community of nations. Later, just 11 minutes past 6 p.m., Harry Truman wrote to the UN General Assembly despite George Marshall's disagreements.
This government has been informed that a Jewish state has been proclaimed in Palestine and recognition has been requested by the provisional government thereof. The United States recognizes the provisional government as the de facto authority of the new state of Israel.
Of forming a Jewish homeland on the promised land did not last long. The very next day, when David Ben-Gurion read the Declaration of Independence at the Tel Aviv Museum, Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria angry with their new uninvited neighbor, attacked Israel. The fledgling Israel had no aircraft nor tanks, and the Arabs were superior against the Zionists in the number of fighters and arms, and their victory seemed certain. The same theory turned into reality, and the Arabs achieved significant victories. The Zionists saw with their own eyes that the Jewish homeland was on the edge of destruction. David Ben-Gurion and his companions had to do something, so they went around the world to buy weapons. Finally, Czechoslovakia and Russia sold arms to Israel. The weapons of the Eastern Bloc changed the equation of power on the battlefield. Arabs were optimistic and participated with part of their power in the war, but they were unsuccessful. The UN was under the US pressure to declare a ceasefire to end the Arab-Israeli conflict and pressured the Arabs to sign a ceasefire agreement with Israel. After 9 months of fighting in vain, the ceasefire put an end to the conflict. The Arabs did not accept the peace agreement with Israel because peace meant the recognition of the State of Israel. The Arabs accepted the ceasefire, not peace. The next Arab-Israeli dispute was over a waterway built in 1869 in Egypt. This canal connected Port Said on the Mediterranean coast to the Gulf of Suez in the Red Sea. This waterway later became known as the Suez Canal. The canal was built so that ships traveling from the west to the ports of the east of the world would not have to go around the African continent. The Suez Canal Company was owned by Britain for many years, but the new Egyptian president, Gamal Abdel Nasser, gave a fervent speech on July the 26th, 1956, in Alexandria, announcing the nationalization of the Suez Canal Company. Then he raised the flag of his country in that region as the sign of this nationalization. All assets of Suez International Company, most of which belonged to Britain and France, were frozen. The French, who resented the Egyptian aid to the Algerian revolutionaries, in addition to the Suez affair, held a secret meeting in Paris with the British, who had been deprived of the huge Suez Canal shipping revenue. This top-secret meeting had a very special guest, Israeli representative Shimon Peres. The French and British believed that they had to inveigle Israel into invading Egypt in order to take revenge on Gamal Abdel Nasser. They knew that Nasser banned Israeli ships and planes from passing through the Strait of Tiran a year earlier in 1955, and this act could have provoked Israel to attack Egypt. Their ideas attracted Peres's attention, and he soon returned to Israel to inform David Ben-Gurion of their secret offer. Ben-Gurion began working on the plan and was sure that it could alleviate the situation. Nasser predicted the war and asked the United States to buy weapons. But Washington refused it because of the 1950 tripartite agreement on the Middle East among the US, France, and Britain. The agreement banned selling arms to countries in the region to prevent an arms race. So Gamal Abdel Nasser reached out to the Soviet Union for economic and military assistance. Czechoslovakia agreed to give arms to Egypt. The proximity of Egypt and the Eastern Bloc could have intensified the Cold War. On October the 29th, 1956, the Israelis invaded the Sinai Desert week later, they occupied it. French fighter jets also provided security for Israeli ground forces in Sinai against the powerful Egyptian Air Force. Israel ignored the importance of power. The United States, which was furious with Israel over its alliance with France and Britain, repeatedly pressured the United Nations Security Council to do something about a temporary ceasefire. On October the 13th, the UN Security Council convened and voted on a draft resolution urging Israel to withdraw its forces to establish a temporary ceasefire. But the resolution was vetoed by France and Britain, and the Soviet Union proposed a similar resolution that had no better fate than the previous one. Dwight D. Eisenhower, then President of the United States, appeared on camera and spoke on behalf of his nation.
The United States was not consulted in any way about any phase of these actions, nor were we informed of them in advance. In the circumstances I have described, there will be no United States involvement in these present hostilities. I therefore have no plan to call the Congress in special session. Of course, we shall continue to keep in contact with congressional leaders of both parties. It is our hope and intent that this matter will be brought before the United Nations General Assembly. There, with no veto operating, the opinion of the world can be brought to bear in our quest for a just end to this tormenting problem. In the past, the United Nations has proved able to find a way to end bloodshed. We believe it can and that it will do so again.
The dispute between the permanent members of the Security Council over the ceasefire was not resolved, and as a result, the UN General Assembly convened a special emergency meeting at the request of the Security Council and issued the ceasefire order by 57 votes. But France and Britain ignored the decree. Nikolai Bulganin, the Soviet Prime Minister, noted the situation of his communist ally, issued an ultimatum to France and Britain to destroy London and Paris with atomic bombs if they did not stop invading Egypt. The next day, the military offensive against Egypt ceased. On November the 14th, the first UN peacekeeping troops were deployed in the area, so the Israeli forces left Sinai. The UN flag established a 10-year ceasefire between Egypt and Israel. This fruitless retreat benefited Abdel Nasser more than anyone else. Nasser was about to become an irreplaceable hero of Arab dreams. In May 1967, when Egyptian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Anwar al-Sadat went to Moscow to meet the Soviet Prime Minister, Alexei Kosygin, he was secretly told that Israel had gathered all its forces on the Syrian border. Anwar al-Sadat was asked to inform Abdel Nasser, the man who became the hero of the Arabs by nationalizing the Suez Canal. This mischievous news from the Russians was in fact a kind of incitement to provoke Egypt to attack Israel. The Soviet Union liked to witness a war in the Middle East, so the power in East and West would be in favor of the communists.
Мы думали, что в политическом плане, даже если война закончится в ничью,
we believed a war could bring us political gains. Even a stalemate could bring us benefits. Egypt had our backing, both political and military. We thought their forces would demonstrate the benefits of Soviet support. So we were confident that the balance of power in the Middle East would be altered by a localized war.
The Egyptian army did not report any movements on the Syrian-Israeli border, but the Russians again confirmed the news. In any case, Nasser did not take the risk and ordered his defense minister, Abdel Hakim Amer, to be ready to attack Israel if Israel invaded Syria. Russia's plan to start a war in the Middle East was turning into reality. Abdel Nasser wrote a letter to the United Nations calling for the withdrawal of peacekeeper troops stationed on the Israeli-Egyptian border since the nationalization of the Suez Canal, so that the Egyptian army could take stand. This measure drew all the attention to Sharm el-Sheikh port in Sinai. Egypt took the initiative and closed the Strait of Tiran in the Gulf of Aqaba again. By doing so, the Zionists' water connection with the east of the world was completely cut off. Egypt blocked the only way for Israeli oil transfer, and that meant the declaration of war.
Our armed forces are ready for war. The Gulf of Aqaba belongs to Egypt. There is no way that we will allow Israeli ships to pass through. The Jews are threatening war. We tell them hello and welcome. We are ready for war. But there is no way we will give up our rights to the Gulf of Aqaba.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. Fretting over a fever in her toddler that wouldn't break, the mother took the young child, Leticia, to a hospital. Doctors had worrisome news, though. It was COVID-19. But they were reassuring, noting that children almost never developed serious symptoms, said the mother, Ariane Roque Marinero. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Anna Inova. The piece is titled, Why is COVID Killing So Many Young Children in Brazil? Doctors are Baffled. Fretting over a fever in her toddler that wouldn't break, the mother took the young girl, Leticia, to a hospital. Doctors had worrisome news, though. It was COVID-19. But they were reassuring, noting that children almost never develop serious symptoms, said the mother, Ariane Roque Marinero. Less than 2 weeks later, on 27th of February this year, Leticia died in the critical care unit in the hospital in Maringá in southern Brazil, after days of labored breathing. It happened so quickly and she was gone, said Miss Marinero, a 33-year-old. She was everything to me. COVID-19 is ravaging Brazil, and in a disturbing new wrinkle that experts are working to understand, it appears to be killing babies and small children at an unusually high rate. Since the start of the pandemic, 832 children, 5 and under, have died of the virus, according to Brazil's health ministry. Comparable data is scarce because countries track the impact of the virus differently, but in the United States, which has a far larger population than Brazil and a higher death toll from COVID-19, 139 children aged 4 or under have died. And Brazil's official number of child deaths is probably a substantial undercount, as a lack of widespread testing means many cases go undiagnosed, said Dr. Fatima Marino, an epidemiologist at the University of Sao Paulo in Brazil. Fatima Marino, an epidemiologist in Sao Paulo, who is leading a study tallying the death toll among children based on both suspected and confirmed cases, estimates that more than 2,200 children under the age of 5 have died since the start of the pandemic, including more than 1,600 babies less than a year old. "We're seeing a huge impact on children," said Dr. Marino. "It's a number that's absurdly high. We haven't seen this anywhere else in the world." Experts in Brazil, Europe, and the United States agree that the number of children's deaths from COVID-19 in Brazil appears to be particularly high. "Those numbers are surprising. That's a lot higher than what we're seeing in the United States," said Dr. Sean O'Leary, the vice chair of the American Academy of Pediatrics Committee on Infectious Diseases, and a pediatrics infectious disease specialist at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus. Dr. O'Leary added, "By any measure that we're following here in the United States, those numbers are quite a bit higher. There is no evidence available on the impact of variants of the coronavirus, which scientists say are leading to more severe cases of COVID in young, healthy adults and driving up death toll in Brazil on babies and children. But experts say the P1 variant of the coronavirus, which has spread widely in Brazil, appears to be leading to higher death rates among pregnant women. Some women with COVID-19 are giving birth to stillborn or premature babies already infected with the virus," said Dr. Andre Ricardo Ribas Freitas, an epidemiologist at São Leopoldo Mandic College in Campinas in Brazil, who led a recent study on the impact of the variant. Dr. Ribas Freitas added, "We can already affirm that the P1 variant is much more severe in pregnant women. And oftentimes, if the pregnant woman has the virus, the baby might not survive, or they might both die. Lack of timely and adequate access to healthcare for children once they fall ill is probably a factor in the death toll," experts say. In the United States and Europe, experts say early treatment has been key to the recovery of children infected with the coronavirus. In Brazil, however, overstretched doctors have often been late to confirm infections in children, Dr. Fatima Marino said. "Children are not being tested," she said. "They get sent away, and it's only when these children return in a really bad state that COVID-19 is suspected." Dr. Lara Shakirdemian, the chief of critical care at Texas Children's Hospital, said the mortality rate for children who get COVID-19 remains very low, but that children living in countries where medical care is uneven are at a greater risk. A child that might just need a bit of oxygen today may end up on a ventilator next week if they don't have access to the oxygen and the steroid that we give early in the disease process, Dr. Shekhamedian said. So what might end up as a simple hospitalization in my world can result in a child needing medical care they simply can't get if there's a delay in access to care. A study published in the Pediatric Infectious Disease Journal in January found that children in Brazil and four other countries in Latin America developed more severe forms of COVID-19 and more cases of multisystem inflammatory syndrome, a rare and extreme immune response to the coronavirus, compared with data from China, Europe, and North America. Even before the pandemic began, millions of Brazilians living in poor areas had limited access to basic health care. In recent months, the system has been overwhelmed as a crush of patients have flooded into the critical care units in hospitals throughout Brazil, resulting in a chronic shortage of beds. There's a barrier to access for many, said Dr. Ana Luisa Pacheco, a pediatric infectious diseases specialist at the Heitor Vieira Dourado Tropical Medicine Foundation in Manaus, Brazil. Dr. Ana Luisa Pacheco said, for some children, it takes 3 or 4 hours by boat to get to a hospital. The cases in children have shot up amid Brazil's broader explosion in infections, which experts attribute to President Jair Bolsonaro's cavalier response to the coronavirus pandemic and his government's refusal to take vigorous measures to promote social distancing in Brazil. A lagging economy has also left millions of Brazilians without income or enough food to eat, forcing many to risk infection as they search for work. Some of the children who have died of the coronavirus already had health issues that made them more vulnerable. Still, Dr. Fatima Marino estimates that they represent just over a quarter of deaths among children under the age of 10. That suggests that healthy children, too, seem to be at heightened risk from the coronavirus in Brazil. Leticia Marinero was one such child, her mother says. A healthy baby who had just started walking, she had never been sick before, Ms. Marinero said. Ms. Marinero, who was infected along with her husband, Diego, a 39-year-old, believes her daughter, Leticia, might have lived if her illness had been treated with more urgency. I think they didn't believe that she could be so sick. They didn't believe it could happen to a child, said Ms. Marinero. She recalled pleading to have more tests done for her daughter. 4 days into the child's hospitalization, she said, doctors had still not fully examined Leticia's lungs. Ms. Marinero is still unsure how her family got sick. She kept Leticia, a first child the couple had badly wanted for many years, at home and away from everyone. Her husband, Mr. Marinero, a supplier of hair salon products, had been cautious to avoid contact with clients, even as he kept working to keep the family financially afloat. For Ms. Marinero, the sudden death of her daughter has left a gaping hole in her life. As the pandemic rages on, she says, she wishes other parents would quit underestimating the dangers of the coronavirus that took Leticia's life. In her city, she watches as families throw birthday parties for children and officials push to reopen schools. The virus is so inexplicable, she says. It's like playing the lottery, and we never believe it will happen to us. It's only when it takes someone from your family.
Thank you.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Last Days in Vietnam, directed by Rory Kennedy. And joining me in the studio, we have Dave Calhoun, who is a film critic with Time Out magazine. And beside him is Lindsay German, who is the founding member and convener of the British anti-war organization Stop the War Coalition. Now, Last Days in Vietnam examines the chaotic final days of the US's presence in Vietnam and their efforts to help evacuate 135,000 South Vietnamese people as the North Vietnamese forces were closing in on Saigon. Featuring contemporary reflections from those who were there, this documentary also shows the moral dilemmas faced by US soldiers and diplomats during the unsanctioned evacuation.
We today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam. We have adopted a plan for the complete withdrawal of all U.S. combat ground forces. We are finally bringing American men home.
The American troops were gone, and as a result, the House of Cards began to collapse.
We were dealing with an ambassador who was just convinced that somehow there wouldn't have to be an evacuation, and therefore there wouldn't have to be a concern about evacuating South Vietnamese.
These people were dead men walking. Sometimes there's an issue not of legal and illegal, but right or wrong. I borrowed a truck, and I drove them to the airbase. I had told them, when you hear three thumps, that means hold the baby's mouths, don't breathe, don't talk, don't make any noise. I was going to get them out.
The final battle of Saigon has begun.
That morning, there must have been at least 10,000 people ringing the embassy.
There was a sea of people wanting to get out. They looked up at the helicopters leaving, and I could see their eyes. That's good eyes.
There are no words to describe what a ship looks like. The hull is 200 and it's got 2,000 on it.
We have no more helicopters. That's it.
As it took off, I could see the group right where we had left them. It was just so serious and deep a betrayal. Who goes? And who gets left behind?
Well, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, the U.S. Fought in the Vietnam War for nearly 20 years, from 1955 to 1975. And, of course, their alleged role was to stop the spread of communism. But, of course, in this documentary, it doesn't really talk about this aspect of the war. More so, it focuses on the last days of the U.S. troops in Vietnam, as the title of the documentary suggests. And, Dave, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, how would you summarize what Last Days in Vietnam is about, and what was your take on it?
As you say, it's a particularly human story. It looks at the, as the title says, the final days of American involvement in 1975 in South Vietnam, and particularly in Saigon. After the withdrawal of troops in 1973, there were still between 5,000 and 7,000 U.S. military personnel or advisors still in South Vietnam, many of them in Saigon. And what the film does is, using archive footage and new interviews, it builds up a portrait of what happened in April 1975 as those US personnel had to scramble to leave the city and the country, and also what they decided to do or not to do to help those people, South Vietnamese and those living in Saigon, who they knew and who they'd been working with, many of them were in relationships with, or who they considered, some of them considered family.
They were very well integrated into the country.
Yeah, absolutely. So some moral dilemmas that come up through that. I found it a pretty gripping film, actually. And it's a micro portrait of this particular chapter in the history of the Vietnam War. I mean, this final chapter is very well put together, and it's I found it pretty illuminating. Mm.
And Lindsay, if I could turn to you now, would you agree with what Dave said? What was your take on this documentary?
Well, I agree with Dave. I thought it was a very good film, and it got across this sort of moral dilemma very, very well. I think my big criticism of it is not about the film itself, and maybe this shouldn't be a criticism of the film, but that the context of what's going on isn't really developed in the way that it should be. So you see sort of pictures of maps that the North Vietnamese are coming and are surrounding Saigon and are just a few hours away and all this kind of thing, without actually sort of looking at the backstory of what happened. So I think it was it's a very well-made film. It's a very human story because it's about what happens to the people, which can happen in any war where you're on the losing side, and what then happens, and it can be very, very hard for people in that circumstance, and you can understand why both the Americans wanted to get their friends and family out, and also why some of the South Vietnamese thought that if the North Vietnamese came, they wouldn't have much of a future. Mm-hmm. But I think that lack of context also does weaken the film's message, I suppose, or gives you one side of the message. Mm.
And I want to tear apart, actually, the more on the political context of the film in the next part of the discussion. But just for now, we're going to take a brief break.
This big Chinook showed up. There's no way he can land on Kirk without impacting the ship. He would have killed everybody on this helicopter, plus my crew.
It was way too big to land. We thought that the helicopter would just fly away. But as the ship was moving forward, probably 4, 5, 6 knots, something like that, the pilot communicated that he was running low on fuel.
He opened up the port side of the helicopter and he hovered across the stern of Kirk. Then all of a sudden, here comes a human.
One by one, we jump out. I jumped out, my brother jumped out. My mom was holding my sister, obviously very scared. And she just, just trustingly, just with one hand, with her right hand, holding on with her left to brace herself, just dropped my baby sister.
One fellow standing there, and he said he looked up and he saw this big bundle of stuff come flying out, and it was a baby. It was the 1-year-old baby. And then the mother jumped out and he caught her too.
There are some really great evacuation stories in this film. And just before we went to that clip, as you were saying, this from a cinematic perspective, this documentary is a great documentary. And Lindsay, if I could ask you, what evacuation story stood out the most to you?
Well, I like the whole way that they did it. The thing that perhaps I remember most is this thing where they say that there was this signal, which would, when they knew they had to evacuate, which would come on the radio, and I forget what the phrase was, but then they said they would play Bing Crosby's White Christmas, which I thought was perhaps one of the most bizarre things in terms of what was going on in Vietnam, the whole war and everything. So I suppose that really stood out. But lots and lots of people trying to get there, the people, and even with that message was the message about White Christmas, was you have to come with your family to the embassy with only one suitcase, which I guess is a pretty, you're getting out, but you're getting out with not very much stuff. So I thought they were very moving. And the one about the man who went and got his family, the Vietnamese pilot who went and got his family in his helicopter and just took the helicopter, went and got his family and got them out. So they were very moving stories, I thought, and they were, obviously people were in a very desperate situation.
Indeed, and according to this documentary, the events described in it includes the stories of some 77,000 South Vietnamese people. And Dave, if I could ask you the same question, what story stood out the most for you?
I agree. I mean, there's very, very many there. And I agree also, actually, yeah, some of those code slogans and things they hear on the radio are particularly, they do stick in the mind. To be honest, actually, I mean, as well as all the stories of the people that do leave, I mean, some of the stories that stick in my mind are the hints of the people that were left behind. I mean, towards the very end of the film, we see some of those very famous images of people clambering over the walls of the US Embassy after the last 11 people are helicoptered away. I mean, one of the many powerful evacuation stories is of the last of the 11 US soldiers clambering into the helicopter. But there's one there's one person who recalls, a South Vietnamese man who had been a soldier, who recalls how, as soon as he realized, you know, Saigon had fallen, it was over, North Vietnamese were all over the city, and he took off his uniform, got rid of his badge, burnt his military identification card.